Today, it's not so bad after all. The Property Imperative Weekly to the 31st of August 2019. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. August is a tricky month, in the north at least, thanks to the holidays, lighter trading volumes and skittish markets. Just remember that September and October are often the months where big stock falls have occurred. But we're going to start with a quick view of international markets, then look at the local scene. But if you want to go direct to the Australian section, the time is shown below. And in the comments section, we've listed out the main chapters in this week's show. Wall Street ended the week with a lackluster session on Friday. Investors were cautious ahead of a holiday weekend. While the S&P 500 registered its biggest weekly gain since June, August had its biggest monthly decline since May. Investors fled risky assets in August due to escalations in the US-China trade war and the inversion of a key part of the US yield curve, which is often a recessionary signal. US financial markets will stay closed on Monday for the Labor Day holiday, and a new round of US tariffs on some Chinese goods were expected to come into effect on Sunday. Ahead of that, trading volume was light and the indices wandered around their neutral point. After last week's icy blast on trade, now it appears both the US and China are giving more promising signs on trade as they discuss the potential next round of in-person negotiations in September. But many think that the markets have been overly optimistic about a resolution to the trade dispute. Economic news was mixed, with US consumer spending increasing solidly in July as households bought a range of goods and services. But a survey from the University of Michigan, also out on Friday, showed its consumer sentiment index in August had dropped by the most since December 2012 amid nerves over the US-China trade war. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 0.16% to 26,403. The S&P 500 gained 0.06% to 2,926. And the NASDAQ Composite dropped 0.13% to 7,962. Volumes on US exchanges was 5.77 billion shares, compared with the 7.13 average over the last 20 trading days. And the Dow saw 16 days where changes were 100 points or more. The volatility index was up 6.15% to 1898. The S&P 500 finished the week up 2.8%, while the Dow rose 3% and the Nasdaq was up 2.7%. The S&P 500 finished August with a 1.8% loss. The Dow fell 1.72% and the Nasdaq dropped 2.6%. And for the year, the S&P 500 was up 16.7%, while the Dow rose 13.2% and the Nasdaq was up 20%. The Euro-US dollar was down 0.58% to 1.0991, while the US dollar index futures was up 0.31% to 98.73. Gold was down 0.5% to 1,529, while crude oil fell 2.73%. The Bitcoin US dollar was up 1.4% to 9,630. Interest rates moved lower, with the 10-year yield falling to 1.505% from Thursday's 1.516%. The spread between the 10-year yield and the 2-year yield narrowed to negative 0.77 basis points, continuing the yield inversion that has many concerned a recession may be in the offing. The 2-year yield was 1.51%, and the 3-month was up 0.12% to 1.989. Fed futures indicates nearly a 100% chance of a rate cut at the mid-September FOMC meeting. Meantime, bonds continue lower. In fact, many of the bond market fluctuations reflected record low yields in Europe, where German 10-year yields traded below zero. US bonds are getting a bid from investors overseas looking for somewhere that they can put their money and to get some sort of positive return, something which the Treasury market still delivers. But that demand pushes the yield lower, And it's worth saying that fundamentals now are very different from the last time when there was a recession in the US. Interest rates tended to be a lot higher then than now, and both in the US and overseas. So some are questioning whether, in fact, the inversion really does signal a recession. There is also concern over where Hurricane Dorian will make landfall. The National Weather Service says the storm, now a Category 3 hurricane, but likely to strengthen, will hit somewhere in Florida, although nobody knows exactly where it will track. The quarter two earnings season wrapped up in August with better than expected overall results. Many analysts had thought earnings would decline for the S&P 500, but according to S&P Global Market Intelligence, earnings actually rose 1.9% year over year. US economic growth also continues to chug along, though at lower levels than a year ago. And by late August, the Atlanta Fed's GDP indicator now predicts a 2.3% growth rate in the current quarter three. Ahead, markets are likely to remain volatile for as long as the China situation remains unresolved, but US consumers have been outspending money, retail earnings reports have been incredibly strong, and jobs reports have been good. But on the other hand, there are concerns that business leaders might be rattled by the China trade war, something which Powell alluded to in his speech at Jackson Hole. Durable good data for July showed new orders for primary metals, fabricated metal products, and machinery all declining, and a lack of business demand might be the initial sign of falling consumer demand, and the retail sector is waiting for more certainty ahead. In the UK, the Brexit confusion continues as the October deadline approaches. Parliament will take an extended break, perhaps to avoid extended discussions. But analysts at Citigroup said that Britain's banks could face a hit of up 25% to their earnings if Britain crashes out of the European Union without a deal. The economic slowdown would result from a no-deal Brexit, as well as the likelihood of lower interest rates and borrowers defaulting on loans. That would hit earnings per share by between 15 to 25%. This is actually one of the most concrete assessments yet of the impact of no deal on Britain's banking sector. And Royal Bank of Scotland said earlier that deteriorating economic conditions before Brexit were likely to derail next year's profitability and that some customers were already struggling. And Royal Bank of Scotland was up 1.09% to end at 185.45. The FTSE index of banks in Britain has fallen 7% this year as lenders grapple with pressures on profits from competition in the mortgage sector, ultra-low central bank interest rates and high fixed costs. Across Europe, there was a sigh of relief as Italy's latest political drama petered out after the country's five-star movement and the opposition Democratic Party said they would try to form a coalition, setting aside years of hostility to avert a snap election and the economic uncertainty that comes with it. European shares rose nearly 1% and Italy jumped 1.7%, where the government bond market borrowing costs also rallied to record lows. China's yuan had dipped for an 11th straight session, although a firmer-than-expected central bank fixing helped stem deeper losses. And on the latest trade war development, China said it and the United States were discussing the next round of face-to-face trade talks in September and voiced hopes that US President Donald Trump would cancel plans for additional trade tariffs. The Shanghai Composite Index was down 0.16% to 2,886. The latest hit came in Argentina, as it said it wanted to restructure a large chunk of its bonds by extending the maturities and to reprofile the maturity of debt owed to the IMF under a $57 billion standby agreement. So this is still one to watch. Hi, it's Liz Interruption. But if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. So now, turning to the local markets, all the signs this week are pointing to a weaker GDP number ahead. Westpac's estimate is for an annual GDP of around 1.4%. They say it is clear that the economy slowed sharply over the past year, moderating to a sluggish pace. Annual GDP growth eased from an above-trend 3.1% in mid-2018 to a forecast 1.4% in mid-2019. That is the weakest pace since the GFC back in September 2009 and is below population growth of 1.6%. They suggest that quarter two growth was driven by exports and government spending. Private demand may have contracted. A forecast minus 0.1% over the quarter or minus 0.4% over the year. And that's the weakest outcome again since the GFC in March 2009. Home building is declining, so too business investment, while consumer sentiment is soft. They think that output growth will strengthen, though, over the second half of 2019 and into 2020, but still it will be at a below-trend pace given the ongoing challenging environment, even allowing for rate cuts and tax cuts. In our earlier posts, we walked through the weaker construction activity and the fact that credit growth remains anemic, both below expectations. Yet the kook has gone full bore, suggesting that the conditions are in place for house prices to rise 20%, perhaps more, over the next few years. Conveniently vague, I might add. He said easy credit, demand vastly outstripping new supply, rising incomes, albeit modest, are all feeding the beast. Incomes going up? Now, where did that come from? And Christopher Joy has joined the bandwagon in the AFR, saying, pity the perma bears because the great Aussie housing boom is back. As we predicted in April 2017, when prices were still in free fall, the value of bricks and mortar has started to rise quickly following the first two Reserve Bank of Australia rate cuts. In Sydney, home values have surged an incredible 1.3% in August, the biggest jump since March 2017, according to CoreLogic, and Melbourne prices are appreciating almost as rapidly, climbing 1.2%. In August, the best result since May 2017. Even the subdued Brisbane market has recorded two consecutive months of capital gains. Across Australia's five largest capital cities, home values inflated more than 0.8% in August after a 0.1% gain in July. That makes August the strongest month nationally since April 2017. Now, RBA Governor Philip Lowe said this week, we can be confident that lower interest rates will push up asset prices. And I think that later on, we will have problems because of that. So it's worth remembering where we are in terms of private debt to GDP, never higher and unsustainably so. And we will be updating our mortgage stress data in the next few days to see the latest impact on household finances. And Deputy Governor Jubel argued this week, house prices have stabilised, but it doesn't seem to me, he said, to be off to the races. And UBS added, we are becoming less sure the rebound of auction clearance rates and around the 10% month-on-month annualised pace of home prices in August is a blip rather than our risk case. It becomes a new trend. And ABC 730 did a puff piece on the property market this week, citing Domain, that there is a turnaround in the Sydney and Melbourne markets. Prices have even started to increase again. It's always generally been seen that the high end of the market moves first, said Domain, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. It doesn't hold across all of the cities, but generally we expect that the high end of the market leads and provides an indication for what other markets could do in the future. Well, we'll see. And SQM Research wrote that the Sydney housing market has bottomed out. Many leading indicators are now suggesting the current September quarter will record about a 2% rise in Sydney dwelling prices, and they expect a rise of another 4% in the December quarter. That should take the full year to about a 1% gain compared to 2018. But, they said, let it be known, Sydney has bottomed out at an overvalued point. The data suggests that the Sydney housing market remains 21% overvalued despite the two-year correction. Now, this is based on their modelling of GDP to prices, which I find, frankly, less than useful. I think price to income is a better measure. But certainly, CoreLogic data continues to suggest a meaningful recovery in Sydney and Melbourne. So the CoreLogic index to the 29th of August 2019 is showing that in Sydney, Prices rose 0.37% over the last week. They've risen 1.26% over the last month. They're up 1.58% over the quarter. Annually, they've fallen 7.3%, and from peak, they're down 13.6%. In Melbourne, they're up 0.44% over the last week, up 1.2% over the last month, up 1.69% over the last quarter. They've fallen 6.5% over the last year, and they've fallen 9.7% from the last peak. In Brisbane, prices rose 0.22% over the last week. Over the last month, they've risen 0.17%. Over the quarter, they've fallen 0.17%. Annually, they've fallen 2.1%, and from peak, they're down 2.2%. In Adelaide, they fell 0.05% over the last week. They're down 0.28% over the last month. They're down 0.92% over the last quarter, and they're down 1.1% over the last year, and 1.6% from the last peak. In Perth, they're down 0.33% over the last week. They're down 0.64% over the last month. They're down 1.88% over the last quarter. They're down 9% over the last year, and they're down 20.7% from peak. And over the five majors, they were up 0.27% over the last week, up 0.81% over the last month, up 0.86% over the last quarter, down 6.3% over the last year, and down 9.9% from peak. And so, turning to the annual movements based on the CoreLogic series, we can see that prices in Sydney have started to accelerate quite considerably over the last 2 to 3 weeks. A bit similar in Melbourne, and Brisbane is moving up just slightly, where Adelaide is moving sideways, and Perth is continuing to fall, and the five-city average is higher as a result. And auction clearance rates ended at 74.2% as reported by CoreLogic, with 1,415 auctions, compared with 1,915 a year back, when the clearance rate was 54.6%. This is a Sydney and Melbourne-centric event, and the low volumes need to be taken into account. So let's look at some more granular data. Units in Strathfield are down 11.9% over the past year and are heading lower. Houses in the same area are also down to 11.6% but might be turning higher. I think this illustrates the point. Houses in some areas may be recovering slightly, but that is not the full story. Look further out from the CBD. For example, at Marrickville in 2204, houses are down 9.4% while units are down 4.9%. But Bexley 2007, houses are down 19.3% and continues to fall. Beverly Hills in 2209 is down 18.2%. Earlwood is down 20% and Kingsgrove is down 20.2%. And remember that Roy Morgan reports that unemployment and underemployment is at 18.3%, and that probably is a truer representation of the state of play than the official figures. This will limit lending, as we saw in the latest figures, and we discussed these in our post, Credit Fudge Anyone, where we discuss the data issues surrounding the numbers. The one-month numbers show a small rise in unoccupied loans from 0.2% last month to 0.5%, a level last seen in September. Investment lending fell 0.1%, personal credit fell 0.4% from the previous month, and business lending was up from 0% last month to 0.2% this time. Even those with a bullish disposition have to admit this is weak. And of course, the data is always noisy, so there is really little to see which might signal an improvement. So looking at momentum in housing credit, the three-month annualised growth pace is 2.6% currently, moderating from 6.8% in mid-2017. And by segment, three-month growth rate is 4.4% annualised for owner-occupiers and is down 0.5% for investors. And turning to business credit, this grew by 3.9% over the past year, up from 3% for 2017, but still representing a moderation from gains of 6.4% in 2015 and 5.5% in 2016. So it's true to say there is little evidence to show the stimulus from lower cash rates or APRA's loosening has made any substantive difference, which, by the way, chimes with our recent household surveys. See our post, The Property Buying and Selling Discontinuity. And the construction sector is clearly under pressure. What with the rising tide of defective buildings, a lot more reported in Melbourne now, less work done and lower approvals, with residential building approvals down 9.7% month on month in July. UBS is forecasting a decline in construction jobs of around 100,000 by the end of the year, and that's pretty close to our own SME surveys, as traders report a slowing jobs pipeline and less available work. And Adelaide Brighton, Australia's biggest cement group, expects the residential construction market to bottom out in 2021 and has embarked on a $30 million cost-cutting blitz to try to offset falling demand. Chief Executive Nick Miller is bracing for ongoing weakness in the housing market. Our view is that the turning point is at least 12 to 18 months away in this sector, Mr. Miller said. This economic news is having a negative impact on the Aussie, which is now in the low 67 cents region and may well fall further. The continued fall in the iron ore price might be helped by a falling Aussie, but remember, we will be importing inflation, so fuel prices and other household costs will go higher, something which the RBA seems to favour, by the way, as a method to try to keep inflation in the 2-3% band. And here is the latest from the local markets. The ASX 100 rose 1.52% on Friday to end at 5,475. The ASX Financials Index rose 1.64% to end at 6,221. The Local Volatility Index was down 2.92% to 14.35 on Friday. ANZ rose 1.6% to end at 26.74. CBA was up 2.12% to 79.05. NAB was up 1% to 27.36. Westpac was up 2.1% to 28.22. The Bank of Queensland rose 0.77% to 9.17. Bendigo and Adelaide Bank rose 0.45% to 11.18. Suncorp was up 1.17% to 13.81. And Macquarie was up 1.07% to 123.84. And Macquarie announced a significant capital raising this week, which suggests that they've got more plans ahead. AMP rose 1.5% to 1.70. The lender's mortgage insurer Genworth fell 0.96% to 308. McGrath fell 4.35% to 22 cents. And Yellow Brick Road was at 6.9 cents. Mortgage aggregator AFG ended at 2.25, and Mortgage Choice rose 0.86% to 1.17. The Aussie US dollar was up 0.22% to end at 67.39. The Euro US dollar fell 0.73% to 1.6309. And the gold Aussie cross was down 0.5% to 2,258, whilst the Bitcoin Aussie cross was up 1.56% to 14,361. Finally, more on the cash transaction ban. The Australian ran an excellent piece today arguing the ban makes no sense, entitled "Draconian Cash Bill Treats Us All as Tax Dodging Criminals." As Katrina Grace Kelly wrote, we should all worry about something important and real. Next year, we could be sent to prison for 2.5 years for the crime of taking $10,000 of our own after-tax money in cash and buying something such as a car or an item of jewellery off someone with an Australian business number. And no, you can't buy something for $10,000 and split the payment into two parts, and both parties to the transaction will be equally prosecuted. And John Adams and I released our latest video about the cash ban. Only together can the people break the Morrison government. This is an important show, so please do go and watch it. So in summary, there are still some very dark clouds on the horizon. Maybe the trade arrangements with China will ease back. Maybe home prices will move higher. But the underlying economic conditions for Australia look pretty sick at the moment, and frankly, I don't see any way out of that. And because of that, whilst I tend to think that prices will probably move up a little in some locations, it's a temporary situation. And frankly, next year, prices are likely to fall further again, in line with our scenarios. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.